Hello and welcome. Let's go and get started with today's top stories. More Palestinian civilians are slaughtered in Gaza as the Israeli military continues to pound the blockaded territory with more attacks. In one of the deadliest strikes, at least 66 Palestinians were killed after Israeli warplanes struck a residential area near the Kamal Adwan Hospital in Beit Lahia, northern Gaza. More than 100 others were injured in the attack. Israeli warplanes also carried out an air raid targeting a house, a school housing displaced Palestinians in the Nusayrat refugee camp, leaving nearly 10 people killed. In a separate strike, nearly two dozen Palestinians, including 10 children, were killed in an Israeli attack on a home in the Sheikh Ridwan neighborhood north of Gaza City. The deadly strikes come as nearly 44,000 civilians have been killed so far and more than 104,000 others injured in Israel's genocidal war since October last year. Academic and political analyst Isabella Zaidan, who earlier joined us from Damascus, believes Israel is covering up its failures by committing more atrocities in Gaza.
Ever since the attack started on the north of Gaza 44 days ago, of course, Israel has been committing a lot of atrocities, a lot of heinous acts that cannot be described by words, by any human words or any language used by any human around the world. However, these atrocities are only to cover the losses and the death tolls and the casualties that Israel is losing, this temporary regime is losing among their forces ever since the start on the northern Gaza. And it's they just want to hide the fact that they are losing a lot of tanks, a lot of artillery, a lot of soldiers. And of course, by doing this, by doing these heinous acts, they are covering their losses. And second of all, they are trying to promote the fact that winning this war is all about killing as many civilians as possible and destroying infrastructure. Well, if you look to the other side, to the Palestinian resistance, what they're doing is just they are causing a lot of losses among the forces of the Israelis, and because they're not criminals, they're not killing any civilians, they're not destroying infrastructure that is not related to the conflict.
The United States has vetoed a UN Security Council resolution that called for a ceasefire in the Gaza Strip for the fourth time in a row. The move comes as Washington continues arming Israel despite the regime's genocide in the besieged territory. Here is a report.
On Wednesday, Washington voted down a resolution for ceasefire in the Gaza Strip at UN Security Council, while the other 14 members of the council voted in favor. The draft also called for release of captives held by Hamas resistance group in Gaza, but U.S. officials said the language was not strong enough as it did not condition the ceasefire on the release of captives.
We cannot support a resolution that calls for an unconditional, immediate ceasefire.
Following the vote, representatives of countries attending the Security Council session spoke out against the move.
If it were not for the repeated use of the veto by the United States or its claim that the UN Security Council resolutions are non-binding, the United Nations Security Council would not be so weak and ineffective.
For months, the U.S. has been confusing everyone and obstructing the UN Security Council efforts of developing a response to a catastrophic situation in Gaza, pandering to one side of the conflict in order to achieve its own political goals at the cost of Palestinian lives.
There's no justification whatsoever for vetoing a resolution trying to stop atrocities. No justification for that.
Iran also condemned the U.S. veto as disgraceful and said it reveals Washington's full contempt for innocent lives and peace. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas said by vetoing the resolution, the U.S. once again demonstrated its direct complicity in the aggression against Palestinians. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad also called the American administration a partner to the genocide, an accusation that is even echoed in the United States.
What this extremist government has done in Gaza is unspeakable. But what makes it even more painful is that much of this has been done with U.S. weapons and American taxpayer dollars.
Sanders was speaking ahead of a resolution seeking to block the Biden administration's recent sale of $20 billion of weapons to Israel. However, with 79 to 18 votes against the measure, the Senate blocked passage of the resolution. The U.S. provides Israel with at least $3.8 billion in military aid annually, and the Joe Biden administration has authorized $14 billion in further assistance to the regime since the Israeli genocide began.
Well, joining us now from Brussels is Dr. Gilbert Doctorow, an independent international affairs analyst. Thank you very much for joining us, Dr. Doctorow.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
Thank you. Doctor, this is the fourth time that the U.S. has actually vetoed this resolution, and I do have to ask you, were you, first of all, surprised at all?
Well, I think it is worth noting that the resolution was introduced, was backed by Bernie Sanders. Because Sanders is an independent, though nominally, actually, he's a Democrat, the point is that in the U.S. Senate, the Republicans have stood as a bloc against Palestine and in favor of Israel, whatever it does, whereas the Democrats have been split. And Sanders is a visible sign of that. This was a major factor in the November 5th elections, that the Democrats could not be counted upon to support Harris because so many of them were disaffected, were alienated by the Biden administration's support of Israel's genocide in Gaza.
Well, Doctor, I mean, as we know, this has been the case with the U.S. under President Biden, but now we have President-elect Donald Trump coming into power in around 2 months from now. He has made promises of ending the war in Gaza while at the same time continuing his strong support to Israel. Do you believe we'll see anything different under Donald Trump in concerning Gaza?
I would not take his nominations to fill his cabinet or his words, his pre-electoral words about support for Israel, as meaning there will be no positive change in direction for the Middle East and specifically for Gaza under the new administration of Donald Trump. I see here an overall pattern which also is reflected in the area that I follow most closely professionally, the Russian affairs and the war in Ukraine. Mr. Trump takes strong stands. He makes very militant sounds. But these are necessary preliminaries to stepping in and reaching out and finding solutions, which otherwise, if they are made by a person who is perceived as weak or as indecisive, would be impossible to achieve. Mr. Trump sounds tough, but I think Mr. Trump, once in office, will be far more accommodating and reasonable and realistic than anyone in the present administration. And this also is a message for Iran. I think it's highly possible that notwithstanding his appointment of a number of well-known anti-Iran personalities to his cabinet, Mr. Trump in the first 6 months will reach out for an accommodation with Iran.
Well, Doctor, I mean, I do have to ask you, this is, again, no agreement on a ceasefire. And as we already see the extremely difficult situation the Gazans are especially living in the area, how much worse do you believe we can see the situation going?
Well, it's impossible to say how many more thousands will be killed. And the numbers that you have put up, 43,000, are official numbers, but unofficial numbers are five times greater. So the situation in Gaza is horrible. How much further devastation and murder Israelis can perpetrate is unclear. But I do think that the end is nigh with the incoming Trump administration taking finally a positive action and moving back from the kind of vicious activity that you have shown a few minutes earlier in the U.S. vote in the Security Council.
Well, that was Dr. Gilbert Doctorow, an independent international affairs analyst, joining us there from Brussels. A pleasure to have you, Doctor. Thank you very much. Israeli military forces have conducted fresh attacks on Lebanon, leaving more dead and injured among civilians. At least 9 people have been killed and 70 injured in fresh Israeli airstrikes on the southern city of Tyre. The Israeli warplanes have bombarded the town of Rumin and the village of Kfar Shuba in Nabatiya region. Earlier on Wednesday night, Israelis pounded towns in Ma'arakah and Bint Jbed in southern Lebanon. The Israeli aggression against Lebanon began in October last year and intensified in late September. Since then, over 3,500 people have been killed and more than 15,000 injured. Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah is pressing ahead with its retaliatory operations against Israel deep inside the occupied territories. Israeli media say at least one person has been killed in Nahariya following a rocket strike from Lebanon. Over 24 rockets were also fired toward western Galilee. There are no immediate reports if the strike left any casualties there. Hezbollah says it has carried a number of strikes targeting several areas across the occupied land. That includes targeting the headquarters of the regime's Golani Brigade north of the occupied city of Acre. The resistance movement also inflicted losses on the regime's infantry force in southern Lebanon. According to the Israeli military, 2 soldiers were killed during clashes with Hezbollah fighters early on Thursday. A terrorist attack on a Shia Muslim convoy in the Parashinar region of Pakistan has left at least 20 people dead. The victims, who were mostly women and children, were traveling to Peshawar in northern Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province. To get more information on that, we are now joined by our correspondent in Islamabad, Nasir Akazmi. Welcome, Nasir. How are you? Hopefully all is well. Thank you for joining us. Nasir, I do want to go ahead and ask you, I mean, this is, again, not the first time we have seen something like this, and no one has claimed responsibility, even though in Kuram it has been a scene of sectarian violence in recent months. Could you go ahead and enlighten us with any further details you might have there as being on the ground, and have the authorities actually held anyone responsible for this atrocity?
Well, it's a sad day in Pakistan. Again, we have seen that the terrorists have struck the Parachinar district, which is close to the Afghan border. This incident happened today in Kuram tribal region when a convoy of more than 40 cars were enrouted to Peshawar, the provincial capital of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province, and this convoy was intercepted by gunmen who are said to be pro-Takfiri groups, terror groups, who have been engaged in the killings of tens of thousands of Shia Muslims in recent years. So this attack was the same similar attack as we have witnessed in the past. And initial reports confirmed that 20 people have been killed in this attack. However, I have the latest figure with me, which have been released by the Kuram hospital, which says that 35 people have lost their lives so far, while 29 are injured in this attack. These casualties included the women and children who were traveling to Peshawar, the provincial capital of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province. Emergency cleared in the local hospitals, where doctors are asking for blood donations because many of the injured are said to be in critical conditions. This is another fear that the death toll may rise further as many of the injured are in critical conditions. The emergency has been declared there, and the reports confirmed that this was the convoy which was scheduled to go for Peshawar when it was intercepted by the pro-Takfiri militant group in Kuram tribal region today. Pakistan has been asking Afghanistan to take action against those militants who are hiding in Afghanistan and quite oftenly by crossing border and come in Pakistan and attacking the civilians, especially this Parachinar is the victim of these attacks. We have seen in recent months, in August, there were more than 60 people, Shia people, were killed in similar attack. And now, since then, the roads, this key route on which this attack today occurred, was closed for more than 5 weeks. And the people have faced a severe humanitarian crisis in the Parachinar district because the key routes leading towards the provincial capital, Peshawar, and the rest of the country remain suspended for more than 5 weeks. And the people have been staging protest demonstration, the people of Farah Chinar have been facing severe hardships and asking the authorities to reopen the road. However, we have seen that last week there was a tribal elders meeting in which it was decided that, yes, we are going to open this key route for the people of Farah Chinar, but they will be escorted by the security forces. Even though this convoy was escorted by the security forces today and militant attack, and more than 34 people have been lost their lives in this incident so far. Pakistan's Foreign Affairs Ministry has condemned the recent attacks carried out by militants who are said to be hiding in Afghanistan. And today it was a briefing by a spokesman of Pakistan Foreign Affairs Ministry, in which the spokesperson clearly said that the Kabul should do its best to stop these militants, and Pakistan has provided several times those evidence which clearly indicate that these militants are involved in attacks on Pakistani soil. Last day we have seen that yesterday there was a massive attack on security forces in Bannu district, which was claimed by one of the notorious Tehrik-e-Taliban faction, in which 12 troops were killed and several other was injured when a militant stormed a security checkpost in Peshawar. There was a very high-level meeting by Pakistan's Prime Minister in which the top military leadership were also present, and it was decided that Pakistani security forces will retaliate against yes. those militants who are targeting Pakistani civilians, especially in north northwestern tribal region, as well as the southwestern Balochistan province.
Yes. Well, Nasser Kazmi, our correspondent from Islamabad, thank you very much for giving us those updates. Well, that's all we have for this hour. Please stay tuned for more updates. Thank you and goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website at iranradio.ir. log on to our website at iranradio.ir.
Hidden files. We have now been witnessing horrific scenes coming out of Gaza as we have watched the Israeli genocide continue there. As we know, the problem Palestinians have with Zionists did not start on October the 7th. But why is it that many people in the world are just finding out about this story? And now that they have found out, what could it mean? Well, stay with us as we take a look at this and more on this Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashemi, and welcome to the show. Today, we're going to talk to an American journalist who was just as misinformed as most Americans, but then did research on the Palestinian-Israeli issue and what she discovered would change her life, but also change the life of many others forever.
Here is an American activist and writer known for her interest in the topic of the Israeli occupation of Palestine. She's the founder and executive director of the nonprofit organization If Americans Knew, president of the Council for the National Interest, and author of Against Our Better Judgment, The Hidden History of How the U.S. Was Used to Create Israel.
I'd like to welcome journalist Allison Ware to the program. Allison, thank you so much for being with us here on Hidden Files. What would you say, as an American journalist and editor of a small town weekly in Sausalita, turn your attention to the issue of Israel and Palestine to begin with?
As you say, I was just the editor of a very small newspaper, so I was not covering international news at all. But in the fall of 2000, when my youngest son had left home for the university, and I had a little more time just to be curious about things, the Second Intifada was in the news in the U.S. So I was seeing these images of sometimes children throwing stones against tanks. And, I decided for the first time in my life to pay attention to the issue of Israel-Palestine. You know, for most Americans, that seems very far away, confusing if you're not Jewish. You don't feel it has any real connection to you. But in this case, I was curious, so I looked into the, I decided to follow the news coverage. And when I did that, I noticed that it seemed very one-sided. As a journalist, as you know, you're supposed to look into the full story and hear from different people. And I noticed that we were hearing from and about Israelis in great detail, as I wanted. But then I thought and expected that I would hear from and about Palestinians also, since there are two parties in that conflict. And I noticed that came much less frequently. So I felt I was really getting one side of an important story. Google and the internet was pretty new back then, but I realized that was a resource I could try to use to learn more about what was going on. And I started to do some internet searches, which was brand new. And I discovered that there were news sources in the region itself that were giving information day by day, sometimes hour by hour. So after work, I would start looking into those. And I learned that unarmed Palestinians were being killed every day in large numbers, many of them children. This was covered in considerable detail. I also learned that the U.S. was at that time giving Israel $8 million per day. I'd never known that, and I think almost nobody knew that. It was never mentioned in U.S. news coverage. So I saw that there were really atrocities and human rights violations going on every day using my tax money, and yet it was not being covered in the American media. So it seemed to me this was the biggest cover-up I had ever seen.
Well, Allison, tell me about your trip to Palestine. I think that trip changed your professional life.
That changed the course of my life. Yes, after a few months of doing that, I began to think this was so important. I needed to go and see for myself what was going on. So in February and March of 2001, before the 9/11 attack, you know, many months before the attacks on the World Trade Center, I traveled over to Gaza and the West Bank as a freelance journalist. I traveled around by myself. This was before the ISM movement. So I was there just as a journalist with my notebook and small camera. And I saw firsthand what was going on. I saw firsthand small children who'd been shot. I was in the home of a family whose little son had just been killed by Israeli forces. I went through neighborhoods in Gaza that were already bullet-riddled. You know, I remember thinking it seemed like pictures I had seen of World War II, with massive destruction in some of those neighborhoods.
And this was you said 2001.
That's right, early 2001. So this is long. No Palestinian rockets had been fired yet. Hamas was not in charge yet. That was many years in the future. And it was already, there were already these major attacks on Palestinians, also in the West Bank and in Gaza. Children being shot, people being shot, homes being destroyed, shelling of entire neighborhoods, both in Gaza and in the West Bank. So I saw that and experienced firsthand. And when I came back to the United States, I decided to start an organization that would be non-ideological. It would be to reach every American across the political spectrum of every religion and ethnicity. And I named it If Americans Knew, because I felt if other Americans knew what I at that time knew, we would have very different U.S. policies.
Well, Allison, what do you think is the most important aspect of U.S. and Israeli relationships that If Americans Knew, it would make a difference?
There are a number of things. One of the main things to start with is that we are giving Israel massive amounts of money. So therefore, we're responsible for what Israel does. And it gives us a connection. Many people, as you know, are busy raising children, working jobs, trying to keep things together. There are many important issues around the world and in the United States. So when this just seemed like a faraway, distant, confusing issue, most people don't pay enough attention to it. But when they realize, wait, we give more of our tax money to this tiny country than anywhere else, I'd better pay attention. So I think it's first learning that they have a very significant connection to it. And then when they learn what's going on, there's the human reality of seeing the tragedy that's being done to Palestinians that began, you know, over 75 years ago. It's not new. And beginning to learn the history of it, you know, about every issue from the American media, yes, often from broadcast media, you know, radio and TV. And so the key is what's the information there? And much of it's being covered up. Much of it's just not there. When they do learn about Gaza, some of the reports barely mention the facts of what's actually going on. There'll be a few seconds maybe, and then they'll focus on the Israeli hostages and make them humanize their families, the and never hear about the, you know, many thousands of Palestinian prisoners that are held without trial, without charge, often physically abused, psychologically, certainly psychologically abused. So there's the problem is that most people that try to pay attention to the news on this issue are often getting very incomplete news, sometimes really fallacious news.
I mean, what would you say the effect on people watching this ongoing genocide take place in real time?
I think many of us, it's just excruciating. I think many people around the world and, you know, many of us just find it horrific to watch day after day after day. Right. Hundreds more people being killed every day. Many of them, most of them women and children. And just going on day after day after day. The thing that's different about this genocide than many in the past is that we are seeing it. Those of us that know where to look, that follow Al Jazeera and Press TV and other places, are learning these facts every day. And it's astounding to me that it can continue without the world stopping it, that it continues day after day without people stopping it. And then I realize when I go around, you know, my small town and areas that many people have no idea this is, you know, many of us are following it and seeing it every hour. There are other people that live near us and, you know, within our geographic area who aren't even aware of what's being done to children.
I mean, so you're saying in the middle of this genocide that there's still many people that don't even know about it?
I think many don't. I've been trying recently to watch. I record the news broadcasts, but I haven't had time to be watching them very much. And I just watched what Fox TV has been having. And, you know, I saw that recently they did show briefly images of Gaza, and they did have a brief interview, you know, with, not an interview, but someone, I think it was UNICEF or a humanitarian agency, mentioning about what was going on, but it was just on screen for a few seconds. And this was in the context of Hamas being depicted as terrorists, that Gazans are, you know, that anything that's happening in Gaza is the fault of Hamas, that it's really Israel that's suffering. They there was a report about the Houthi attacks on shipping without any explanation about why they were doing it, why this was, you know, perceived by many people as a very understandable action, given that there's a genocide going on and everybody in the world has an obligation to try to stop it, try to get the world to stop it. But that didn't come through in the news coverage.
Well, viewers, stay with us. We're going to continue our discussion with Allison Weir right after this short break. Stay with us.
Who owns U.S. media? Six media companies control 90% of U.S. media. Four out of those six companies are Time Warner, Comcast, Disney, and News Corp. Asset management firms own large shares in companies that sell weapons of war, and they also own large shares of mainstream media organizations. BlackRock, Inc. and the Vanguard Group, Inc. hold large shares in the world's largest arm-producing company, Lockheed Martin Corp., as well as Raytheon, and the group also partial owns mainstream news media organizations. NBC is owned by Comcast. Comcast is owned by BlackRock and Vanguard. ABC is owned by Disney, and Disney is owned by BlackRock and Vanguard. Times is owned by Time Warner, and Time Warner is owned by BlackRock and Vanguard. CBS is owned by Viacom CBS, which is owned by BlackRock and Vanguard. Fox News is owned by News Corp, which is owned by BlackRock and Vanguard. As the genocide in Gaza continues, it is not likely that Americans will be able to get the true story of what is happening. This is as long as their media is owned by corporations, and several of those corporations are parts of the military-industrial complex. A conflict of interest, to say the least.
Well, thanks so much for staying with us. Allison, I'd like to continue with looking at the journalist side of everything happening in Gaza. Basically, no one is safe, and so many journalists have been killed in record numbers, and yet we really don't hear the condemnation from mainstream journalists that we should be. Why is that the case?
Yeah, there are some groups, some international groups are making strong statements, but most people don't hear about those. I find it especially you know, as I say, just the last day or two, I've been focusing on Fox. So I know the other media are also bad, but right now I'm really, really most aware of the Fox coverage. And truthfully, I've thought this is an intentional obstruction of people learning the facts. It, to me, it's not the journalists that are doing it. They're mouthpieces. I think it's shameful. But what's going on is clearly somebody at the top has decreed that they are not there to give as little information as possible to the American public. I don't think this is just the, you know, mistakes, as you know, with daily news coverage, mistakes can be made, if, you know, operating on a, you know, fairly urgent time scale to try to get the news out. So I don't object when people make a mistake or get things, you know, in a day or two. But the kind of pattern that is becoming apparent as I look at these past broadcasts is that this is an intentional editorial policy that's being made by someone at the top, and it's being carried out by their news directors down below. There's no doubt that that's going on. What I've often focused on the Israel lobby in the United States, because most people are not very aware of that, and there's a real effort to cover up that aspect. Even people that will talk about the human rights violations and the violence often try to cover up the fact that there's a very powerful, very pervasive pro-Israel lobby in the United States that operates in every state. It's certainly very, very off, very influential in Washington, D.C., in the media, on campuses, that plays an important role in this.
I mean, you just talked about the Israeli lobby, and it's absolutely amazing the amount of money that is spent by the Israeli lobby in basically buying American politicians. And still, many Americans don't realize the connection between the politicians and the Israeli lobby.
That's right, and the financial connection is enormous. You know, already it ranges from about $4 to $5 billion per year, which works out to over $10 million per day. But then on top of this, at the end of 2023, there was an effort by Biden and by Congress to give Israel an additional $14 billion.
I mean, do you think that the genocide will have an effect on redefining international law as we are watching this total failure of the so-called international rules-based system?
That's a very good question. I'm not sure. Certainly the what's going on at the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, it will be very interesting to see what results from that. The presentations there on behalf of South Africa of documenting that Israel is committing genocide against the Palestinian population were very articulate, extremely compelling, powerful, persuasive. Of course, most Americans didn't see them. I'm waiting to see what happens, like the rest of the world. Will they find the appropriate finding for the court, or will the governments, because I'm afraid of the power of the United States government, which basically does, as we're seeing with Biden, what Israel tells the U.S. to do, and then therefore the U.S. pressures other governments, will that make a difference, or will justice actually be served in this case? I think it's an important thing to watch and see what happens. So far, the world has failed. There's no doubt that so far the world has failed to do what should be done, which was to stop the massacres that are going on every day and the other abuses. The, you know, U.S. has enabled it. Biden has sent our weapons over there to perpetuate it. More money. The Arab nations, sadly, are not using their power to stop Israel. The European nations are failing to use their power to stop Israel. So you know, the population around the world, I think, is trying very hard. They're these massive marches, many people are writing articles and trying to document what's going on. And so there's major effort by people around the world to stop the atrocities, but the powerful and the governments of the world are failing to use their power to stop this. I don't know when or if that will change.
But you just mentioned about people taking to the streets to protest against this genocide. But do you think that it's also causing an awakening in them about their own governments who are not listening to them and continuing to support the genocide?
I think it certainly is a transitional moment for many people. We saw a comment on one of our Instagram posts today, someone saying, you know, I'm completely ashamed. I had no awareness of this before. But the comment said, now, like millions of people, I'm catching up and I'm learning about it. So I think for many people, it's an aha moment. Like, how did I not know about this? How did I, you know, I thought I cared about human rights. And I didn't even know about this ongoing human rights that started long, long before the last few months. So I think for many individuals, I think I believe there's a movement going on in the U.S. that I think it's still going on among the Muslim Americans. Some of the organizations are that have supported Biden, thinking he would be better than Trump, and have seen that he's not. So there's a movement to use the vote and say, abandon Biden, to not vote for somebody because he's supposedly the lesser of two evils, but to show that that people will no longer vote for somebody who continues to fund genocide. I think that would be a major movement if more people do that. And if candidates realize that they will lose the election because they're doing the wrong thing, they're pleasing their campaign donors, they're pleasing the billionaires that fund their campaigns. But if they say that doesn't work, the voters will still vote against them and they'll lose the election. That could have a major impact. It has in the past. In my long life, I've seen major changes in the United States, in some of our domestic policies, and in the Vietnam War being ended, apartheid in South Africa ending. So I've never seen a genocide of this proportion, I don't think. At least I've never seen something, you know, this ongoing massacres day after day after day, funded by my tax money. I don't think I've seen something this bad before, but I have seen other things that were very bad that have been stopped, that the world has sometimes stopped. So I still have hope, you know, I have to have hope that we will somehow, all the work that all of us are doing in journalism and activism and academia on campuses, in churches and mosques, that all of that eventually will counter the power of the elites that seem to want this to continue.
What do you think is the responsibility of your fellow journalists at this time in covering this genocide and the overall Palestinian story?
I think the obligation is the obligation that we always have, which is tell the real facts, find the real facts, and tell them. Don't water it down. Don't give it spin. Don't leave things out because they're too graphic. I think the obligation is to tell people what's going on, the real life, what's happening to human beings in Gaza and in the West Bank. That it's our obligation to tell the facts, whether or not our governments want us to, whether or not we will, you know, many of us have paid a personal cost for doing this. But that's one of the things we have to do. It's important for everyone to do that.
But you've just talked about the personal cost, Allison, and I know you've paid a price for choosing the reality of the Palestinian story and talking about it all these years. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I have. You know, it's very small, of course, compared to what people in the Middle East are feeling. But so it's a small personal cost. But, you know, I'm called names. I've been called anti-Semitic. People imply that I'm a bigot. They don't imply it. They say that, even though I have a life history of opposing all bigotry. I've been called a communist or a white supremacist. My children have sometimes, it's been uncomfortable for them because then people hear things about their mother that are untrue. I've had death threats. I think that's what happens to anybody and everybody that works on this issue. But I've, you know, fortunately, I've also received some awards for my work and some people have praised it. So I've had negative things, but I've also had positive things. And most of all, I know that I'm doing something that I have to do. So at least I can feel about myself that I'm doing the right thing. And I think that's more important than any of the negatives I've had.
Well, do you have any final words about this continuing genocide and just the overall situation? Final words.
I think it's just appalling that it continues day after day and that we haven't stopped it. Will have major repercussions on the world. I think it could grow into a regional war There are indications that Israel would like that because it would give them the chance to do even more of an ethnic cleansing than they're doing now. So bad as it is now, I'm afraid it could end up, it's already involving Yemen.
Thank you so much for being with us, Allison, on Hidden Files. Well, all of us must ask ourselves, what is our responsibility during this crisis, no matter where one is and what he or she does? He or she can do something. It could be as simple as explaining what is going on in Gaza to a friend. From east to west, we've seen people taking to the streets to protest this genocide. Politicians may not show a reaction to these protests in public, but for sure it is making a difference. The pressure must be continued, and journalists all over the world must do their best to explain the real story of Palestine to help in this genocide, occupation, and siege on the Palestinian nation. I'm Marzia Hashemi for Hidden Files, and thanking you for being with us on another program. Goodbye.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم نیست.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. 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 کتاب
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You are listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Shiraz, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we are going to be examining a very pertinent question. That is a question with which a lot of people ask, especially those people who, who previously were not very religious, but now they want to become more religious. You know, they come and they say, well, we have been, you know, we weren't very religious previously, very religious, or and now we want to, we've repented and we want to know what can bring us closer to Allah. What can lead to us becoming more intimate and more connected to God Almighty? In order to answer this question, which is kind of a ethical and spiritual question, we can take recourse to some of the hadith in which certain instructions have been given to us and advice have been given to us about what can bring about intimacy with God. A beautiful hadith has been narrated from the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam, in which he has been reported as having said the following: He who comes out of the humiliation of disobedience to the dignity of obedience, Allah will grant him intimacy without need for a close friend and elevate him without wealth. So in this beautiful hadith, if we examine it, we see that the cause that leads to a person becoming more intimate and close to God is obedience to Him, and distancing oneself from disobedience from God, ma'asiyat. And coincidentally, the Prophet also said that this person will also be granted status and a rank and respect and dignity. Right? And this intimacy with God is such that even if no one is the friend of this person will never feel lonely, he will always feel like he has a friend. It's been narrated in one of the beautiful hadiths of Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam that he said, even if, this is the gist of the hadith, that even if I had no one to speak with and no one was my friend and all I had with me was the Quran, I would never feel lonely. This is a very beautiful hadith and how pertinent it is today, especially in this time when a lot of people, loneliness is one of those great psychological and you might say spiritual maladies, which a lot of people unfortunately in this world have become afflicted with. In another beautiful hadith, it's been narrated that Imam Ali alayhi salam said, a man who isolates himself away from people will find intimacy with Allah, glory be to him. So, of course, we have to discuss what exactly it means to isolate a person to isolate himself from people. But in brief, it means that a person should stay away from those individuals who might lead him to disobeying God and becoming distant from Him, and so on and so forth. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at what brings about intimacy with God in the light of the hadith of the Prophet and Imam Ali alayhi salam. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program The Key, an IRIB English radio with Sheikh Shiraz, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Lullaby, my darling, lullaby, my son, sleep in peace.
sleep in silence. I've dug the earth with my hands, my bare hands. I've searched for my roots in this soil, this holy land, the land which is yours and which is mine, Palestine. And you, good earth, glorious land, now I offer my son to you. See, I offer my son to you, only to you. I lifted his head from his mother's arms. I put him on your chest, still in my roots. Palestine, 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 Palestine. Lullaby, my darling, lullaby, my child, sleep in peace, sleep in silence. Since the story of my anger and your blood, the story of our mother's tears and your brother's cry, have to take us on, have to take us on. Lullaby, my darling, lullaby, my dear, sleep in peace, sleep in silence. Since some of thee inside my aching heart, some of thee inside our land, our blood joins in sacrifice, sacrifice. Your blood roots me here, this land.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
This hour's top headlines. At least 110 Palestinians are killed and dozens more injured in multiple waves of Israeli strikes on various parts of the Gaza Strip. The U.S. Senate votes down resolutions to halt weapons sale to Israel hours after Washington vetoed a U.N. Security Council resolution for ceasefire in Gaza. And two more Israeli soldiers are killed during clashes with Hezbollah fighters as the Lebanese resistance group continues its retaliatory operations against Israel.